A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week we review David Cameron's speech at Tory Party Conference with Anoush Shakadian, Stephen Bush and George Eaton. Then Stephen joins me and our sub-editor Yo Sushi to talk about cultural appropriation. What is it and what's wrong with it? Well, Tory Conference is over and we've heard David Cameron's speech, we've heard a rather obnoxious speech from Theresa May and a beauty parade of all the other potential Tory leaders. But let's talk first about David Cameron's speech. I'm joined by Anoush Shakadian, Stephen Bush and George Eaton. Anoush, I'm going to start with you because you watched it outside the hall and that gave you a slightly different perspective to those inside the hall, didn't it?
I watched it on iPlayer and I had my Twitter feed open next to me and I was really surprised at the conclusions that were being drawn by lots of the people who were at the conference. They were saying that this was an unashamed sort of lurch to the left for David Cameron. He was grabbing the liberal centre ground, and I actually thought that the speech was the opposite. And I think it is a little bit dangerous to assume that just because the Tory leader is discussing poverty and inequality and diversity more often than he usually would, to assume that this means that he's sort of moving to the centre. I think that's buying the Tory spin that he's doing so. I think actually he's trying to redefine the centre and it's actually quite right wing.
Well, George, you were a bit more sympathetic to that line. And I have to say, having read the speech overnight, there is a lot in there, for example, about the number of ethnic minority Tory candidates, you know, people whose parents were refugees. It wasn't a speech that you can really imagine Margaret Thatcher having given, John Major having given, Ian Duncan Smith having given. So There is a point to that he did make a very un-Toryish speech in the issues that it raised, even if the underlying policies aren't actually that left-wing.
In tone, it was a far more liberal speech than Cameron was delivering before the election. He's not looking over his shoulder at UKIP anymore. You know, equal marriage and foreign aid weren't mentioned much or almost at all during the election campaign. It was striking just how often he mentioned gay rights in that speech, and he clearly wants to claim that as part of his legacy. But I think it's obvious, on the other hand, he hasn't had some sudden conversion to social democratic economics. I mean, listening to Cameron, you wouldn't guess that public services were facing cuts of between 25 and 40%, that working families were going to have their tax credits cut. And just as New Labour sometimes redistributed by stealth, it feels as if the Conservatives are trying to cut by stealth. So they're dressing up austerity as reform. And of course they're shrinking to the state to levels that Thatcher only dreamt of. Tax credits are being cut while inheritance tax is being cut for millionaires. So fiscally it is a very regressive agenda. But I think the Conservative Party itself is clearly far more comfortable with social liberalism than it was in the past. And you know, one Conservative pointed out to me, quite a lot of people, members left the party of equal marriage. So in some ways, that's why Cameron can now get standing ovations for praising equal marriage, for praising diversity, that he couldn't in the past. And I think that's both good policy for the country and also good politics for him.
And Stephen, there's something that someone said yesterday on Twitter which struck me. We all had a big debate over the last sort of 3 years about how terrible UKIP was. There was this split on the right. And someone said, actually, in some ways, you might say that the rise of UKIP has been good for the Tory parties because it's siphoned off some of the people who were opposed to a progressive social agenda. It's allowed Cameron to say things that he wouldn't have been able to say. You know, that block of people has gone. Do you think that's a reasonable thing to say?
I'm instinctively against saying it's good for parties to lose votes, let alone organisational capacity in the form of members. And it did. There were individual seats where UKIP was the difference between a Labour victory and a Tory one. I mean, he did mention gay marriage, I think, in all but one of his conference speeches. You know, I don't support equal marriage, in spite of the fact I'm conservative, I support, because I'm a conservative. He mentioned it last year. That has always been something which he has got religion on, in the words of one of his aides. The big difference, I think, in this year's speech was that there wasn't a need to leave anything for the Liberal Democrats to announce. A year ago, things like Alan Milburn being appointed, that was signed off by Number 10. They do genuinely care about social mobility. The problem is all of their solutions are bad. I think this was basically Cameron managing to... It wasn't so much a land grab for Labour territory. It was a land grab for the bits of policy they'd given the Lib Dems and they kind of wanted to do anyway.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. I didn't see change in the government's stance on anything. And also, if you're talking about gay marriage, I mean, David Cameron... done that. He's done it, so it's easy for him to talk about it now. So it's kind of like he was going over the battles that he's fought and won, which is kind of like shoring up his legacy more so than trying to shift his party to a new plane.
George, I want to ask you a bit about some of the other speeches. Can you give us a kind of thumbnail sketch of Theresa May, George Osborne and Boris Johnson's speeches? Because they're kind of the ones who are considered to be the most... I mean, Nicky Morgan has also said that she might run if and when the top of the visit party becomes vacant. But how did they position themselves in terms of what comes next after Cameron?
So Osborne spoke with the confidence and the assuredness of someone who is now the clear front runner. And it was quite interesting that after giving some very personal interviews recently and you know, the China trip and the trip to the Faslane base, some pretty big interventions, he made quite a low-key speech in the sense that it culminated with an announcement on local government funding and finance, which quite a big move, but a technical one. And he didn't make the kind of personal speech which prime ministers in waiting sometimes do when they talk about their family, they talk about why they're in politics, they talk about their mission. And I think that was Osborne pulling back a bit and recognising that actually the leadership contest could be a long time away. It may well come near the end of this parliamentary term. And does he want to go out on a limb this early on, given that the front runner often doesn't win? And then Boris's speech, he needed a good speech because he entered the conference having been overtaken by Osborne as the front runner. His project, his political mission was in a way predicated on the idea that Cameron wasn't going to remain prime minister, that Ed Miliband was going to become prime minister and it would be his moment. And so his challenge now is to recover in this new era. I think he did that quite well. I mean, it was pre-briefed as quite a serious speech, but actually the opening there were still plenty of good lines. And me saying that Jeremy Corbyn and his supporters have vested interests and interesting vests, I thought was but then it was a more serious speech in terms of tone. And also he opened up quite a big dividing line with Osborne on tax credit cuts. He's quite miffed at how Osborne's adopted the living wage, which Boris had championed for a while, and now he's pointing out, yes, by all means, let's have a living wage, that's great, but can we really cut benefits for the same strivers we're hailing? But it looks like Osborne is very unlikely to U-turn on that.
And Stephen, let's pick up Theresa May's speech, because it was an astonishing speech in that it didn't get... I mean, it got her a great front page in the Daily Mail, who said, "Woman with guts to tell truth." But James Kirkham in the Telegraph said it was ugly and cynical. And to my mind, it was a heavily dog whistle on immigration. There was some talk about the cohesion of Britain not being able to be maintained with the levels of immigration that we had. Do you think it has actually damaged her with her constituency, which I guess in this case is Tory members?
Yeah, I actually think the problem was it wasn't a dog whistle speech. It was a bit like, you remember that bloke shouting, "Jesus, Fenton, Fenton, Fenton." And it was about that, you know, the dogs didn't like it. Because the dogs kind of looked at her as like, well, I know what you're trying to do here. Yeah, I mean, one MP said to me, well, the problem is it's not her speeches, it's her record. You know, that she has. If you are anti-immigration Tory MP, from your perspective, Theresa May has been an utter failure because she has failed to stop the tides, for the benefit of our listeners, I just did air quotes there, the tides of immigration coming in. All she's done is she's successfully nobbled a British export in the form of, effectively, we now, thanks to Theresa May, train a bunch of very bright people and then tell them that they have to go and live somewhere else. And someone said to me, and this is someone who I regard as a kind of core Theresa May supporter, they said, I just thought it was a bit embarrassing, partly because I think her strength, particularly because Theresa May can only become Conservative leader if something happens to Osborne, you know, if tax credits really detonate, if there's some form of scandal. Her strength is, I'm a safe pair of hands, I know my brief, I'm a serious figure. That was not the speech of a serious figure. It also looked so panicked. And there are lots of people who are, particularly there are lots of Tory women who are uncertain about Osborne's appeal. They just don't think he can replicate the Cameron magic. You know, one of them said to me, well, my mum fancies Cameron. And she thinks that Osborne looks a bit evil. And they're looking for someone. There are some Tory women who would like another woman. And a lot of them were just like, oh, but that's the sign of a panicked campaign. I just don't think it looks good to look that. And also, it was vile, personally, but she kind of wanted people like me and you to say that was vile. That was sort of the mission, was for the liberal left to give her some good headlines in the eyes of the Tory right.
Well, but that's what I've written in the magazine this week, is that, you know, the Tories have got this problem of having, as she herself called them, the nasty party. And the problem is that when you can transmute that into strength and reliability and taking tough decisions and slight selfishness, it's not necessarily something that will turn people off. But when people feel that they're doing something bad, when the dog whistle becomes just a whistle, that then becomes something that people then feel bad about themselves for being associated with that brand. And I think that is a dangerous thing for the Tory party, because that existing perception already exists, in the same way that it's dangerous for Labour to be seen as soft on welfare, because that plays to an existing perception that they have. Anoush, I want to finish up by asking you. Jeremy Corbyn appeared at a rally in Manchester, which is relatively, I think, completely unheard of for an opposition leader to do while the government's party conference is going on. It was very well attended. It generated a huge amount of headlines. Do you think it was a wise thing to do for him electorally?
I think that Jeremy Corbyn's association with that protest was negative from the start, because as we've written, a small minority of the people who were there protesting at the Tory conference were doing nasty things like spitting at journalists and shouting Tory scum and generally behaving in a horrible way. And Jeremy Corbyn was associated with that from the start because he was supporting the general protest, not those particular protesters. And he was sort of forced to say that he condemned those actions. I actually think that's quite unfair on Jeremy Corbyn. I don't think he has to be associated with people who are doing that. But because he turned up and spoke at the protest, he sort of perpetuated the problem for him in terms of his reputation. So I think Jeremy Corbyn was probably treated unfairly over that protest, but at the same time didn't help himself.
Well, I think that's probably all the conference excitement we've got time for. I think everybody's due a long overdue nap, maybe a lie down in a darkened room with a bucket of gin and or, I don't know, George salad, whatever it is that you treat yourself to. For the moment, I'll say thank you to Anoush and Stephen and George.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And we host the New Statesman's pop culture podcast, Seriously.
This week, we discussed adaptations in popular culture, so we went to see the new Macbeth movie.
We talked about the BBC series of adaptations like Lady Chatterley's Lover and Cider with Rosie.
And we discussed teen movie adaptions of Shakespeare, including the seminal She's the Man.
If this sounds like the kind of thing you would like, you can find all the details about where to get our episodes on newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Now we want to discuss a phrase that you often hear on the internet, which is cultural appropriation. It's something that's quite difficult to define. For example, when young women wear Native American headdresses at music festivals, that's seen as being cultural appropriation. A New York exhibition which invited white visitors to try on kimono was shut down because that was accused of cultural appropriation too. Yozushi, one of our sub-editors, has written a fine article in this week's magazine addressing exactly what the phenomenon is and whether it is all bad. I'm also joined by Stephen Bush, our Staggers editor. Yo, first of all, just outline to us, when people talk about cultural appropriation, what kind of thing are they talking about?
It seems to be quite a broad definition. You know, from white actors and musicians appropriating cornrows, which are associated with more with like black people, and the headdresses, as you say, to people like Iggy Azalea performing rap again, a musical genre which has its historical origins in African American culture.
So Iggy Azalea, I think, is, so she's white and she's Australian.
Yes.
But as I understand it, she raps in a kind of slightly, like not in her original accent.
Which is kind of what popular music has been doing since time immemorial. You know, Elvis Costello is not, it turns out, an American, yet he sings in an American way. Bonnie Tyler is Welsh, yet she does amazing country music. And another one is Dusty Springfield is a Hampstead girl. You need that.
Yeah. Oh, that is interesting.
Yeah, well, it's one of these things which has happened, but it's become a flashpoint for a lot of anger, as I think outside of the music element of it, people are becoming much more aware of their identities, be it racial, social, you know, in terms of nationality, and people are getting very exercised about it online, which I think could be quite a dangerous, counterproductive sort of anger, really.
Well, Stephen, we're just about to come up to Halloween now, and Halloween is like the sort of cultural appropriation of Christmas, really, because it's when you see, you know, sometimes extremely tasteless Halloween costumes. Is it okay to dress up as an Italian plumber for Halloween?
Yeah, sure, it's cool. I mean, I think the thing with cultural appropriation is it is one of those things where I think mostly a reasonable person, there's a sniff test, isn't there? Like, I might not be able to come up with an obvious difference between blackface and dressing in as an Italian plumber, or even, like, blackface and like, doing your hair in a silly way, but not blacking up and being Mr. T. There is obviously a kind of smell test difference between those two things. And I think the line in Yo's piece that I really like is the idea that there is a kind of an Asian, I'm going to misquote it now, a black HQ, an Asian bureau that decides at what point something is cultural appropriation. The American accents thing sums it up to me. In the bit of Bo where I'm from, like, you know, very few of my friends were white. I'm not white myself. But for the most part, when people wanted to start their own bands, they sung in American accents. They emulated American indie bands, with the exception of a small group of my Bangladeshi fans who emulated American rappers. Well, is that cultural appropriation?
There seems to be, in terms of like today's online activism about cultural appropriation, the distinction which people seem to make is if a oppressive, powerful ethnicity or race or grouping of people take from an oppressed, less powerful group, then it's cultural appropriation. But it's such a distinction.
Which is why I don't think Americans should be allowed to like Downton Abbey. I think there's a really interesting thing here of the fact that global internet culture is so often American-focused. There was a brilliant piece that The New Republic ran about from Indians writing about the fact that all the kind of memes that get to them, all this sort of stuff that is you know, global internet culture is actually very heavily American. The references are very heavily American. And American culture is incredibly dominant in that sense. But I don't think you would ever get one predominantly white elite accused of appropriating something from another white elite of a country. So if you had white Americans dressing up as Downton Abbey characters, that would kind of be fine, wouldn't it?
Well, there's in terms of people supposedly on like similar social levels or perceived as equally oppressed appropriating from each other, there is anger about that, really, I think. For example, I think it was this year, a journalist criticised attendees of the Afropunk Festival in Brooklyn, black Americans, for appropriating the tribal dress of African tribes, saying this is American cultural appropriation of African attire, jewelry, and things like that. So this is someone criticizing African Americans for borrowing from African traditional things. And the criteria which the writer said would excuse those attendees was if they had a heritage or historical link, something to authenticate that relationship with the clothing they chose, which I think is an impossibility, really. I think, you know, what Stephen was saying about a smell test, I think that smell test happens at the point of reception when we see these things. The context at the point of reception is the most important thing in this respect, I think. Because to those Afropunk attendees dressed in tribal African clothes, they weren't really broadcasting that to the African audience. They were broadcasting it to Americans, saying, we're proud of our African heritage.
Yeah.
They weren't saying, hey, dudes over in Africa who cherish these traditions. You know, they weren't like mocking that at all, really.
Because if you take a kind of fundamentalist view of it, you can't do, for example, things like participant observation in anthropology, because that's kind of, you're going in and you're dabbling with another culture. I think that's right. I mean, a lot of this is about power and a lot of it's about respect. I think that's the feeling, isn't it? If someone, for example, the Native American headdresses, which is a real flashpoint, is the feeling that something which is a sacred symbol has been taken and used as, you know, something that you wear when you go and get pissed in a field. And that's there's a very big difference between somebody doing that and somebody visiting an exhibition or interacting with that culture in another way.
Taking is quite already quite a loaded phrase, loaded word, because I think the closer word would be adopting, because nothing has actually been taken from the member of the Native American tribe, say, who cherishes the headdress for its old ceremonial reasons. You know, they still can you know, treasure it in their own way. It's just grown. It's just become part of the cultural language which the drunk festival goer has adopted. You know, nothing's been diminished from the original source. So is it really a theft, is a question I ask.
One of the things I find most interesting when we talk about these things is how often people don't realise that what they see as the cultural symbol of one group has actually probably been initially borrowed from somewhere else. I mean, normally these debates tend to focus on fashion and dress, I guess, because it's just very easy
targets,
to really. You look at something and you see that looks wrong. But, you know, it can happen with food as well, and people get very upset about, you know, like, you know, you nicking the food group. I mean, I've got a terrible feeling that I read a Guardian piece that said that barbecues were cultural appropriation.
No.
But that might have just been a sort of terrible cheese dream that I had. But, you know, most of the...
From who? Caveman?
Well, but most of the staple foods that we have kind of, you know, rice is not indigenous to Asia, potatoes are not, you know, they moved around, and actually almost every continent has ended up with someone else's food. And the same thing with, you know, with words. I think cornrows are quite an interesting example, because there is... I'm sure you would be able to find people plaiting their hair in that particular way, you know, probably even centuries, maybe millennia ago.
I mean, but also with the cornrows thing, so I once in the distant past did have cornrows briefly. Yeah, if someone thinks they look good in cornrows, in my experience, is they're mostly wrong. but, you know, fine, if you want to have cornrows, you know, like, it's very painful, it takes a lot of time, like, you know, knock yourself out, frankly. It's just, yeah, it's this point of, yeah, like, nothing of substance has been. Yeah, it's a bit like, so, you know, the tiny minority of people in a Tory Party conference, you know, they were behaving in an aggressive way in the name of beliefs I myself hold, but my commitment to left wing values hasn't been taken away or besmirched because some idiot spat at someone. And if someone wants to get cornrows in Shoreditch with their silly moustache, well, fine.
I suppose I think that's quite an interesting point. Yeah, I agree that is their own freedom, with one of those kind of Victorian strongman moustaches, hopefully. But Dorian Linsky, who the music writer who wrote a piece about Native American headdresses, one of the things that he once asked was, when we attack cultural appropriation, are we actually just saying that it's bad, that we just don't like it? Can you ever say something is culturally appropriative and good? Because the Rolling Stones, for example, complicated relationship with blues music, they don't get attacked now, maybe they did it more at the time, so much for it, because people sort of assume that they have taken that culture and made something good of it. The Beastie Boys, you know, white rappers, I don't see a lot of hate on the Beastie Boys for what they did.
I think people who think a lot about music can excuse it, because this is how music has always been composed. Elvis is someone I mentioned in my article, and how people still do periodically raise the argument that he stole from...
He do black music so selfishly, use it to get himself wealthy.
Yeah, yeah.
That reference for the day. Yeah.
Well, but if you think about the history of, okay, rock and roll, which led on to all kinds of other kinds of music, like rock music. Chuck Berry, a black participant and one of the pioneers of rock and roll music, took, you know, very liberally from one of his favourite musical genres, which was country music. Maybelline, everyone knows Maybelline, can't you be true? Well, anyway, Maybelline was very closely adapted from a country song, a hillbilly song. Just as, you know, what's that day, the song? Is it 60 Days or something? He's got a song which is basically when the saints go marching in. Hey. You know, there was a real promiscuity where black musicians felt entitled to take from white sources, just as white musicians take from white black sources. You know, banjos associated with hillbillies.
But one of the things that came up in the cornrows row, which was Kylie Jenner, I get my Jenners mixed up, but I'm fairly sure it was Kylie Jenner, the youngest of the kind of Kardashians, and Amanda Stenberg, who was in The Hunger Games, said that the problem here is with people who want to take black culture but sanitize it. So the same problem with Iggy Azalea being that actually somebody like Azalea Banks is too kind of scary for the mainstream music establishment. So what they want is they want the kind of coolness, the kind of glamour of black culture without having to deal with any kind of black people, which white audiences might kind of feel slightly freaked out about.
Well, you can criticize the industry for having that kind of attitude, but the work itself created by musicians and things like that is slightly outside of that. You know, you judge art, be it pop music, film, books, or a visual representation, by the laws of art. You can't just apply the laws of politics around it and then criticize it for that. You know, if you're going to criticize that element of it, you look at the structural flaws in the industry which allow that kind of behavior to go on. You know, it's not as simple as pointing, much as a child would point to a tree and say tree to signal that they understand the word. You know, people, you can't just go around saying cultural appropriation as if that in itself was a negative. You know,
I think we've probably been quite I guess there are more complicated things, but Stephen, have you ever seen something that you have just looked at and gone, oh god, why have they done that?
The weird thing is, I know that once we finish recording, I'll immediately think of one, probably from university when I just did do an awful lot of like, oh, I can't be bothered to have this fight every day. But I think, I guess because I'm mixed race, I think I feel more aware of when occasionally you just kind of hit up against this barrier of, oh no, I'm too black for this conversation apparently. Oh no, I've become white now for. And so I've always been more aware of it as a kind of because the parody, you really should read it once it goes up online. In fact, no, you should do better than that and buy the magazine. the bit I most like, which I'm looking at right now, is this point in, by opposing it unilaterally under the banner of racial justice, activists often end up placing themselves on the side of those who insist on terrifying ideals of purity. White and black should never mix, and the Australian-born Iggy Azalea should leave rap alone. And to be honest, I feel I've had more of a problem with kind of like, oh, I wouldn't have expected you to like the Chili Peppers, or, oh, what do you mean you like Fear of a Black Planet? Your mum's white. Like, that has been a much bigger problem in my own life than, I mean, I hate most of the people who now live in the bit of East London I'm from, but not because they wear silly outfits.
Well, that's one of the, I think in gender terms, that's why I found it really interesting when the NUS last year tried to pass a motion that said they wanted to ban drag for cisgender people. And I wrote a piece at the time that was to that same point, which is that that is actually an inherently conservative move, because what you're saying is that there are some clothes which are appropriate for men and some clothes which are appropriate for women, and wearing the wrong ones in your leisure time should be banned, essentially. Like, the idea that a man wearing a skirt is so kind of horrifying and wrong that it must obviously be a piss take of some kind.
Well, you know, RuPaul, of all people, once said...
RuPaul the great philosopher.
Yes.
I'm pro RuPaul. Well, is it, we're born naked, but everything else is drag.
Yes, yeah, which weirdly kind of chimes very, very closely to what Judith Butler was exploring in Gender Trouble all those decades ago, where she was talking about how our notions of gender, be it masculinity or femininity, are a lot of it is performed. It isn't innate to our being. We perform these things, we learn these things and conform to them. Well, you know, we...
But that's quite useful, isn't it? Because that then allows you to draw a distinction between Katy Perry wearing a geisha outfit and an actor performing in yellowface or blackface, because you are moving from things which are a performance to things which are kind of inherent characteristics.
No, but the thing is, I think what Judith Butler was saying, it was our day-to-day interrelations with other people are also part of that big performance. Our identities are performed in that kind of all-encompassing way. I think race is not entirely dissimilar in that respect. You know, I don't agree with Butler, by the way. I don't think there is this absolute kind of performance element to all of our identities. I think part of it is innate. But that's a conversation for a different...
You know, seamlessly opens up a huge vista of incredibly contested terrain. Probably that's a good point at which to leave it at this point. But you and I can come and argue about Judith Butler in our special like late-night Judith Butler sessions. But for the moment, thank you, Yeo, and thank you, Stephen. Thank you. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.